You're listening to the Book of Basketball 2.0 podcast on the Ringer Podcast Network. We have been redrafting every NBA draft from 1996 through 2008. This is the 2008 draft. Ryan Russillo is redrafting it with me. My name is Bill Simmons. This is the Book of Basketball 2.0 podcast. All right, 2008 redraftables. We went out of order. I did 2009 on the low post. And the reason is because Zach was asking me to do it really for the last 2.5 months. He was so fired up to talk about that draft. So we jumped ahead. So if you want to listen to this 08 one and then go on the low post and listen to 09 to be in sequence, we're also going to run the low post one eventually on the Book of Basketball podcast.
By the way, who'd you take one? I haven't listened to it yet.
In the 09?
Yeah.
So Zach seemed to think that was more of an argument than I did. I thought it was like Curry, hands down. I didn't think about it for more than a second. And Zach agreed, but thought there was at least we should talk about the case for Harden, which I was less lukewarm on because I just, as we've discussed many times in this pod, I just think Curry is the generational culture superstar that we've had. He's dunking for this generation. If he's on your team, you're competing. If you put him with good players, you have a chance to win the title, and he's an iconic player. So that was pretty easy for me. What would you have said?
Yeah. Are you serious?
Well, I just so America listening, they might not 100% know how you feel.
I would have taken Curry one. The only argument you can make for Harden is games, how he holds up. And I know what the raw numbers are, but I wouldn't spend too much time on it.
The playoffs thing kills him. All right, so 2008. Really, really interesting because when I did my redraftables piece for Grantland in 2014, here's what I wrote. Pound for pound, that's our best draft since 1998. Three franchise guys, two all-star assets, two borderline all-stars, 10 starters, and 10 rotation guys. If we had five straight drafts like that one, the league would have to expand to 35 teams. Here's what's fascinating. Except for Westbrook, who I think has gained steam as an asset since 2014, every other guy in this draft was at a higher kind of asset value in 2014 than they are now. And now I look at this draft, it's fine, but it's certainly not anywhere near as exciting as it was in 2014. What happened? What happened to this draft?
Well, Rose got hurt.
He was hurt when I wrote this.
Yeah, but
I just assumed he was coming back at some point and he was going to be 100% again, but it never happened.
Yeah, and I know we're going to do a lot of Rose, so I'm not going to use it all here. Beasley's totally washed out. Mayo has been out of the league for 2 years. I think there's actually been some Westbrook, some anti-Westbrook momentum that's fair since we were just like, wow, this guy's amazing. Kevin Love isn't the same guy.
So that's one of the big losses is that when I wrote in 2014, I considered him to be a franchise player because he was. See, he was coming off a 26-12 season and was a top 10 guy in the league and has never hit that point since.
So yeah, it's a significant, it is like the equator, Kevin Love's career, when you look at just the stats. But now I almost feel like Kevin Love's become underrated. When you dig through kind of some of the numbers that he's putting up. But this is such a weird redraftable because you go, okay, there's a clear one. I'm pretty sure who two is. And then I started doing this thing where I kept ranking them in different orders constantly. And I'm like, don't get so... This was one of the ones where I pushed back on the stats more than other redrafts because I'm going, I just would rather have this guy than that guy. I know what the stats say. I know what the win shares are. I know all the different stuff on this because we can just sort through it all as we have. And it hasn't just been about, I don't want to just go, hey, here's the win shares guys, 1-14, and that's my order, because that's not right. But there's such a like grouping of tiers after kind of the 1 and 2, maybe even 3 guys, where I just started ranking them based on, hey, I just like this guy better than this guy. And because these have become later, there's still a part of who is the guy today, and then who do you expect him to be for a couple of years? Because some of these players, it's weird. A couple of them actually got better recently.
Well, then you had, on top of having some real good guys in this draft, you had this run from 21 to 26 that was really unusual for an NBA draft, where you had Ryan Anderson, Courtney Lee, Kosta Koufos, Serge Ibaka, Nick Batum, George Hill. Six in a row where all of those guys were rotation guys or better. Koufos was probably the worst out of them, but you know, to get go even Ibaka, Batum, Hill, 24, 25, 26 was just wildly unusual on top of some of the other stuff. Roy Hibbert was 17. That seemed really important in 2014. And became a lot less important as it went. But it was just a really deep draft. Dragic is 45. Omer Asik, he was 36.
Mbamute's 37. You know, I mean, so, look, Mbamute played.
So if you're saying, like, what draft had the most guys who were in an eight-man rotation at some point in their career, this is probably a candidate. But let's start here for the biggest story. It didn't feel this way at the time, but I think we really have to play up how amazing that Westbrook pick was, because I loved him that whole year. I watched a lot of that UCLA team. I was writing a lot about college basketball that year in my column, and Westbrook had become my sleeper because he was such a great energy guy and he was such a good athlete, but not to the point I ever thought he would be the fourth pick in the draft. I mean, I thought it was going to be somebody like, man, if you get that guy at like 16, that guy could be a steal. Then he kind of slid into the lottery. Then there was some top 10 potential when the workouts happened. And when they took him, it was a year after Durant. They're about to move to Oklahoma City. They're looking for somebody to compliment Durant. But Kevin Love was a way more obvious pick. And Kevin Love was a better college player. He was more hyped. It was an easier pick, and they didn't even blink. They were like, Westbrook's our guy. What do you remember about that in 2008?
Collison was the guy that ran this, and it's Ben Hallen's offense too. So like, it's not exactly perfect for who Westbrook was, because Westbrook at that point, you're going, okay, what are you really drafting? Because he didn't feel like a point guard. And in a different college offense, he probably would have shown us these things where I think he's arguably at his peak, the greatest athlete I've ever seen playing the NBA. I mean, that's just how special of an athlete that I think he is. But for Presti in the front office to see that over Kevin Love and some of the other guys, it really is one of the most, I don't know if it's underrated, but I'll just put it this way. It's probably as impressive a draft pick as I've seen, because you were like, okay, is he a basketball player though? And sometimes with these athletic guys that we all fall in love with in the eye test, and it's so impressive, and it really was with him. And then I think he even took it to another level. And his ferocity, which I don't think I quite understood, certainly not until he was a pro for a bunch of years, where I go, this guy.
He had it in college, though.
Yeah, but
like he played at a speed in college that was just exhilarating. And he had no idea what to do. It was like watching somebody drive the most powerful car and have no idea how to keep it on the road.
And but to you take could, that guy
the
fourth,
scenes
though,
were there.
Yeah.
It was nuts.
Still, but that's why so many times when I like these things, then I'll kind of come back to like, are you going to be right more often saying, hey, is he any good at the basketball stuff? And when the answer is like a hesitation, usually that player doesn't end up being somebody who's going to end up in the Hall of Fame. And that's, you know, despite some of the warts that I think Westbrook's game has, and I don't know if we want to get into those, but the positive part of this is it's an unbelievable pick, and it's probably even greater than they ever could have imagined.
Well, they also get Ibaka later in the draft too. I mean, this is one of the best. Nailing those two picks and the way they nailed them was probably one of the best drafts anyone had this century, just those two picks. I wrote in my draft diary when they took him, minor shocker, loved his potential, loved him all season. Even I can't defend that one. Quote, who would have thought last year at this time that Russell Westbrook would have been the fourth pick in this draft? Jay Billis asks. And I wrote, last year, what about last week? What about 5 minutes ago? How did Seattle pass on Kevin Love there? Because to me, Kevin Love was a sure thing. At the very least, we knew he was going to be just an insane rebounder, great outlet passer, all that stuff. And I actually liked the idea of him playing with Durant. But Presti, he nails that. He nails Ibaka. And as Zach and I covered in the 09 podcast, really nailed the Harden thing. In the sense of, I can bring this guy in. He's not going to want to be the man. he's the kind of personality that will fit with these other three guys. Like the amount of thought they put into just those moves. And then the last piece, which they had to decline, was the Tyson Chandler trade, which was the secret kind of sliding doors moment for that whole OKC dynasty until the Harden trade, where they have Tyson Chandler. They have to fail him medically. And if they keep him, remember, Tyson Chandler was the anchor of that 2011 Mavs team that won the title. And you think like that 2011 OKC team loses to the Mavs. And they lose to the Mavs partly because they're not quite ready yet. And because Dirk outplays Durant, but also because Tyson Chandler's on the Mavs. And I think if they had nailed that Tyson Chandler thing, I'm not sure what the next decade looks like, but I think OKC would have won a couple titles.
Yeah, and I also want to go back to like the Westbrook thing in that when I talk to college guys after he was, you know, ready to leave after his sophomore year, and I go, you know, what can you tell me about him? And they go, you know, it's something with his body where, you know, a lot of times guys develop later. Like sometimes we forget about that stuff. Like all he's kind of reminded me of the Last Dance doc where they go, how does Scottie Pippen end up here and then there? I'm like, well, he grew 6 inches. How come Michael Jordan was cut from varsity his sophomore year? Well, he grew like 6 inches. You know, like some of these guys that we ask all these questions, like, how did this happen? How did this happen? How come this guy wasn't ranked as high as a recruit? Well, because he was 5'10 and then he was 6'4. Jesus Christ. You know, like
right.
Sometimes this stuff isn't as hard as how your body fills out or some kind of growth spur. And the UCLA guys apparently were saying, you know, Westbrook was somebody who came back in that second year and was just a different cat physically, was just different. And
but was still an overachiever. So he had all the overachiever stuff, but then grew into this world-class body that, as you said, he was, do you really think he was the greatest athlete you've seen in a basketball court? I think he's in the top like 8 or 9 for me, but I wouldn't say number one.
Yeah, I think he's the best. I really do.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's little stuff that he does. And yeah, look, I mean, I've done it before and it's fair. You know, I like, if you're going to talk about somebody, like talk about all of it. And the rebounding numbers have been padded because for a bunch of years, if you were a big guy, you weren't allowed to go get a rebound. But what kind of countered that for a guard having these insane rebounding numbers is he would follow his own shot, which you don't always want to do in the NBA, but he would follow his own shot because out of your hands, you know if it's going to be a miss. And the defender would go to box out the shooter and Westbrook would run around him before the... And we're talking like NBA athlete wings, not even getting a hand on Westbrook as he would go get the offensive rebound and flush it. And his drives... I was watching some clip they had of him the other day because he and De'Aaron Fox were going at it about who was fastest end to end. And the way he can take off and just fly through all of these bodies, I do think it's physically, you know, you could say, hey, LeBron's bigger and what he does at that size. Okay, that's fine. Shaq's footwork, Hakeem and all this different stuff. But I just think raw ball of muscle and athletic power at his size, I really think it's the most impressive thing I've seen.
And ironically, Rose is in this draft. He's the number one pick. I think, you know, through 2011 would have been inconceivable. He wouldn't have been the first pick in the redraft. But what's funny is I always felt he was on the short list of athletes for me, like the way you talked about Westbrook. And there was a couple points in 10 and 11 and then post-lock in the lockout season when Rose and Westbrook went head-to-head on league pass. And it was like watching two superheroes athletically like battle powers. They were... I mean, the Rose thing, if they ever have the Rose documentary, I hope they interview me because I'll never forget going to a Clipper game. I think it was the lockout season. And just I was just in absolute awe of some of the shit he did. Like the way the torque that he would put on the lower half of his body as he was driving into three guys and just stopping on a dime when he was going 22 miles an hour and then going in the other direction. And it was like, what the fuck is going on? And he was going against Eric Bledsoe, I think. I want to say they were going head to head at one point. Or maybe it was Bledsoe Westbrook. But Bledsoe was another guy like that where the athleticism, you're just like, oh my God. But Rose versus Westbrook, that's one of the, there's so many reasons to be bummed out why Rose got hurt. And when we do the redraft, we have to factor in that was a fluky ACL injury. It was 47 seconds left in the first game of the 2012 playoffs. They were co-favorites with Miami at that point. And I think if he doesn't get hurt, I don't know why he wouldn't have had a career at least as good as Westbrook. I honestly think he could have been just as good. I think he could have had just as much success. And I think statistically he could have been as good. I don't think he would have had the rebounds.
No.
But I think he would have been a 25-7, 28-7. And then as the league, as we go into 2014-15, when it starts to open up and it becomes so much easier for guards to get to the basket, you know, could he have developed a three-pointer? Maybe. He's kind of done it in the late part of his career a little bit anyway. But I just think he would have been as good.
Yeah, the difference would be, though, you can say it's a fluky injury, but clearly injuries affected Rose differently than they did Westbrook. Where Westbrook, I think it's that Portland game where he had a dent in the side of his head and you could see it. And he was like, check ball. Like, let's fucking go. And Rose was not like that. You know, the Bulls thought Rose was ready to go a couple times. Remember the playoff thing? And then it was like, okay, now he's not. And so if Rose hadn't gotten hurt, okay, fine. Yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I just think that they have completely different approaches to how they felt about their bodies after the fact, where Westbrook would have to be missing an arm and then he would still just dribble left, where Rose, let's face it, I mean, injuries got in his head a little bit here and it derailed a career that I actually can't believe how productive he's been now. Because at this point, like for him to be scoring 18 a game these last couple of years, and he was bad 3-point shooter this year. He was pretty good last year for him because he was never a great shooter. But I love that Rose has had some kind of reclamation to his career here. But you're right, peak Rose. And if you go back to that battle, it was Beasley number one most of the year. And then Rose has that run through the tournament and you start thinking about the league and the Chris Paul types and you're going, you know, what's really important now? And this is pre-obsession of shooting here. But can you get one of these guards that's so athletic? Like, it just felt like overnight, like, look how sick these athletes are at the point guard position. And I need one that can break people down and get to the hoop. Now, in college, there's a lot of small guards that are pretty athletic that can get past guys and then finish in college. But there's a whole different level of finishing at the rim as one of those smaller guards. Like, Telfair is a good example. Telfair, good handle. He wasn't an athlete like Rose and Westbrook. But even if he got by the defender, once he went to the rim, nothing was going to happen for him. He just wasn't going to be able to finish consistently enough and get you enough buckets. So then you're like a drive and kick guy. And then once everybody knows you can't even finish at the rim, it changes what you're doing when you're closing out on shooters. Rose could get around anyone. And then he could still, as people were shading towards him on a drive or just ready to make up for something, he'd still finish all of those guys. So at his peak, I don't know that anybody was better than Rose was. Prime Rose of just ball in his hand, getting to the hoop. Because you're right, the stuff that he did, it was different. And, you know, again, it's not the only guy, but it just was different at his peak.
In a league where it was much harder to get to the rim, you know, because you just had more bodies in the paint, things like that. Two things off of what you said. Zach and I talked about a little in the 09 draft. 07, 08, 09. The league is really starting to shift in what they value with a prime guy, right? Because Oden versus Durant, which we covered, there was still that mindset, if I have a franchise center, that's the best thing I can have. 09, Memphis doesn't want to know what to do at number two. They end up taking Tabeat. It's still that mindset, when in doubt, go with the center. But at the same time, the smarter teams are looking at it and going, you know what? The league's changing. The best thing you can have is a perimeter guy. You can build a contender around somebody who's an awesome perimeter guy. And I think with Rose, you saw it in that first rookie season when they end up going against the 09 Celtics without KG. They have that legendary round one thing. You come out of that, you're like, oh, this guy's a future Hall of Famer. And every checkpoint he hit, he wins the MVP in year three, controversial MVP.
Yeah, he shouldn't have won it. He shouldn't have won it.
But nobody's been able to tell me who should have won it is the problem.
You don't think LeBron should have won it?
I actually would have voted for Wade.
There was such an anti-LeBron thing because it's his first year down in Miami. The numbers are better for LeBron across the board. Chicago had four more wins. Let's face it. It was another one of those things. And I'm not knocking it because it happens, but it was the story of Chicago's own in his third season, bringing the Bulls to a one seed.
No, there was more to that because he was really, in crunch time, it was him or bust. They had all role players. And I always thought LeBron, at least, you know, he's playing with Wade and Bosch. Here, if I had to do it over again, I picked Rose at the time, even though his stats, when you look at it, LeBron's stats were a little bit better. But the move was Wade, because Wade had an awesome year. I think Wade was the best player in the league that year and all the way through the finals until, you know, Dirk caught fire in the playoffs and did the whole thing. But Wade was just unbelievable that whole season. But on top of it, he does this mastermind move where he gets Bosch and LeBron to come to Miami. I feel like that should have counted as part of the MVP.
I think it worked against him.
Yeah, but I'm saying 9 years later, it's like we actually should have factored that in. Like, not just the statistical resume, but the fact that he convinced the reigning two-time back-to-back MVP to come play in his team. So anyway, the Rose MVP, it's a good argument because, like, Zach voted for Dwight Howard that year. It was one of those years where there just wasn't a good enough choice and everybody kind of did whatever they wanted to do. A couple more storylines. You mentioned Michael Beasley. So Rose went first to Chicago. Miami was on the clock at number two. They had a great tank season that couldn't have worked out better. They got rid of Shaq, all this stuff. And there were a couple red flags with Beasley that I forgot about until I did the research.
Six high schools?
Well, you had all that. You had all the head case stuff that we knew about. But the reality is, in college, he was 25 and 12. I mean, he was putting up numbers that, if you look at what college guys have averaged, the numbers he averaged that year, it's pretty much a lock. You're going to be a good NBA player unless you, like, you know, commit a felony or something. Kansas State listed him at 6'10" all year. They did the pre-draft camps and he was 6'7". Red flag number one.
But I imagine that's socks, right? 6'7" socks. They can't be 6'7" with shoes, right?
Red flag number two. Riley was still working out dudes up until, like, the day of the draft. I think he brought in Jared Bayless. He brought in, who was the other guy? OJ Mayo. Almost like he knew. And then I think the upside was just too high. But Beasley is the type of guy that over and over again sucks somebody into taking him too high. We all knew what the baggage was. The 6'7" thing was the deal breaker for me. I at that point, I was like, I don't. Just seems too high, but also couldn't really. I just would have taken Kevin Love. I don't know why they didn't. But what do you remember about that in 08?
Just that it was Beasley's year. It was most of the year. You know, it's not the same thing, but it's happened other years where Jahlil Okafor was, for the most part, like, oh, he'll go one. And then you were like, I don't know, Karl Anthony Towns is better. And then you were starting to get more reports on Jahlil's defense and lack thereof. And now you're like, wait a minute. Jahlil's like, this isn't even a one versus two. Like, Towns is definitely going one, and we don't know where Jahlil's going to go. And it was Beasley one almost the entire year. And I remember early on being a Rose guy, but it wasn't like it was because I was off of Beasley. It was just those things that we were talking about. How special this kid was at getting to the hoop and breaking down a defense and going, that's what the league seems like it's becoming. And I had heard all sorts of stuff about Beasley, and none of it's awful. You know, it's not, it's just a lot of little things where you still would talk yourself into it too, because you go, okay, he was at a bunch of different high schools. Yeah, okay, he was a little difficult. Like, how the hell did he end up at
Kansas
State? By the
way, Amari had all the same stuff.
Yeah, so it's not, you can't always sit there and say because a guy's had this weird high school thing going on that it means he's a bad guy. I mean, DeAndre Jordan's an awesome example of how misleading some of this stuff can be before the draft, where, you know, we'll get to that later, but, you know, he goes in the second round, and I was going back and looking at some stuff, and it was, oh, there's rumors about this and rumors about John J. Jordan. By all accounts, everybody loves that guy. Like, every teammate has loved him. Have you never heard anything bad about him? So sometimes it's misleading. Sometimes it's accurate, but doesn't mean anything. And in this case with Beasley, I had a scout who is one of my, you know, I've got a bunch of guys that I talked to who was, hey, he's like, look, if you take Rose one, I get it, but you're passing on a Hall of Famer in Beasley. And that's what the thought was of Beasley at the time. But for Miami, they apparently were still calling up, hoping that the Rose-Beasley thing at least was close to Chicago. It was never going to be the case because he was their guy. And then it became, is Mayo a better fit than Beasley for Miami? Which, if you go back and read stuff, it'll say that it was. But it was a two-man race. It really was a two-man race here. So even Miami, this is kind of the mock draft thing. Even if they liked a different player better, it was just hard to imagine anyone was passing on Beasley at two at that spot.
I think what's amazing is he's played over 600 games. So it's not like he didn't get derailed by an injury. He wasn't like a major drug guy, anything like that. He just wasn't that good of a pro. Like his third year in Minnesota, he averaged 19 a game, 32 minutes a game for Minnesota. It's pretty good. You know, that's his per 36 is over 20 a game. He never came close to that again and bounced around Miami, Minnesota, Phoenix, back to Miami, Houston, Milwaukee, the Knicks, the Lakers. Seven teams have rolled the dice with him. And he does have moments. You'll be flicking league pass and he's on and the announcers are excited because he scored 17 points in a quarter. He is one of those guys, but it just never panned out. We should talk about OJ Mayo really quickly. Heading into that college year, he was considered a potential transcendent prospect and got a lot of high school hype, was somebody that we all kind of felt like was going to be a potentially special NBA player. I always liked that. To me, he was like an overqualified 3-and-D guy. He could handle, he had a terrible performance in the tournament and just everybody kind of cooled off on him. And, ends up going third to Minnesota, which doesn't seem great. Nobody wants to go to Minnesota at that point. This is, you know, David Kahn isn't even there yet. Minnesota flips him along with the Marco Yarick and Antoine Walker and Greg Buckner contracts for the fifth pick to Memphis, along with Mike Miller, Brian Cardinal, Jason Collins. And they take Kevin Love five. That was a great trade by Minnesota. And a not good trade by Memphis.
Yeah, great trade. And it's funny because reading some of the mock draft grades after the fact, it's just how obsessed we get about mock drafts. I'll never forget Neil Olshey, GM of the Trailblazers, telling me early on, he goes, mock drafts change everything. They really do. He goes, if it weren't for mock drafts, your owners wouldn't be reading them, you know, all this different stuff. Like the results would be different, but you become married to kind of this order and that this guy's too high there or that's too low. And it's like you talk yourself into all this stuff. And one of the draft grades was Minnesota really wanted Love, but at three, he was too high.
Right.
It's like he went five. Most people thought he was going to go four. Now, if you can get the asset and pull that off in Memphis, who just had this awful run, then go ahead and do it. Like I'm not, but the idea that three is too high for Love when they thought he was going four and he went five.
Well, the other thing is Minnesota gets Miller in that trade. Then a year later, they're able to flip him with Randy Foy for the fifth pick in the draft from Washington. So that trade was just awesome. Two other trades. Indiana had the 11th pick. They took Jared Bayless. Then they flipped him with Ike Diagu.
Oh,
for the 13th pick to Portland. Got Brandon Rush, Jared Jack, and your boy Josh McRoberts back. So that trade happened. And then Toronto acquired Jermaine O'Neal from Indiana. And this was amazing when it happened because Jermaine O'Neal was kind of washed at this point, but Toronto didn't realize it. They traded TJ Ford, Raso Nesterovic, and the draft rights to 17th pick Roy Hibbert, all for the chance to have a washed up Jermaine O'Neal. So that was weird. So those are big trades. The other two fuck-ups that actually affected the next 2 years of playoffs, Cleveland had the 19th pick, which was pretty good, coming out of almost, you know, puncher's chance of making the finals in 08. They took J.J. Hickson, and they missed out on that whole Lee, Courtney Lee, Ibaka, Nick Batum, really anybody who could have helped them over the next two playoffs. And then the Celtics, this made me mad at the time, FYI. 30th pick, they took J.R. Giddens over DeAndre Jordan. And I even have a joke in my draft diary when it happened. Like, why wouldn't they have just brought DeAndre Jordan in for KG camp? Just bring him in. It's like, here's your mentor, KG. KG's going to teach you how to do all the KG stuff. I actually would have been a really good pick for them. And the J.R. Giddens thing was bad. So there you go.
Yeah. Just watching DeAndre Jordan run, you're like, how are 30 guys going to go ahead of DeAndre Jordan? I think whatever happened with him, I think some people may have done him wrong. And
I agree with you. I think there was bad buzz about him, and I think he got sabotaged by it. Because, like what you said before, I was going to the Clipper games in 09 and 10. He was like a joyful guy, and he seemed like I remember even writing about this. He knew everybody on the other team, every game, whoever the opposing team was. He knew six guys on the other team, and he just seemed like he was this beloved character. And it was like, I thought this guy was a head case. He seems like joyous. I don't understand this. So everybody fucked up.
Just
on that
to
one.
See somebody that big run the way he did, and you go, normally this guy, like if he's DeAndre Jordanovich, he's the 11th pick. Like there's no doubt because
what'd you call him?
DeAndre Jordanovich?
DeAndre Jordanovich?
I just threw a little Vitch on there. The Hibbert part of this is great too because there's a redraftable where you're trying to figure out where he's going in the lottery, and he went from teams fighting over maxing him as a restricted guy to out of the league. It felt like overnight to, wow, Miami has no answer for Roy Hibbert to, we can't play him in games. And that felt like it was a couple years, but it felt like a span of a couple weeks.
Portland tried to max him, right?
Yeah, Portland offered him a tender. And that's my favorite thing is getting to talk to front offices when other teams tender their guys and they get so pissed about it. And it's like, you guys do the same thing. Like you did it 3 years ago to this other team. Yeah, but that was different.
Right. A couple comedy things from the draft. Apparently, this is from my draft diary, Mayo's nickname was The Juice, which is kind of hard to believe anybody wanted to be The Juice after The Juice, O.J. Simpson, double murderer.
Okay, well, I got to jump in because he's also a.k.a. The Grocery List.
Oh.
Which well, that, I didn't know.
That didn't
I
work either.
That. Yeah.
Jay Billis thought Michael Beasley reminded him of a cross between Derek Coleman and Roy Tarpley.
Wow, that's amazing. What a call.
Yikes.
No, but is that one of the greatest calls ever?
So I said, I'm setting the over-under of Beyond the Glory episodes involving members of the 08 draft class at 4.5. We might be there because we have Derrick Rose, Michael Beasley, OJ Mayo. Is there a fourth one?
What's the criteria?
Westbrook will get one. I don't know. What was the criteria for Beyond the Glory? I thought those were documentaries that were like had a little edge to them.
Yeah, the other thing, too, in that tournament game you mentioned, Mayo had 20, but he just missed a bunch of shots, but he lost to Beasley. The K-State,
I lost,
that was the Mayo. Yeah,
I lost money on that game. It still bothers me.
So it still bothers you? Because remember the Mayo thing, too. I remember once somebody described the recruiting, because he was a West Virginia kid, and it was like, well, what was the USC thing? And it was, this is early branding stuff, but it was he wanted to be in L.A. because of his brand. He was going to stop by for a year, do his thing.
Post-Matt Leinart.
Right, and then it was all investigated, and we all know the wins were vacated, although it's not like they had that deep run. But I was told that the recruitment was someone from Mayo's camp called USC and said, hey, he's coming to USC. And it was like, okay. Like that was, the school was told he's coming.
Well, the other thing, he was legitimately old. And did he shave a year off his age at one point?
Are we talking
OJ? Because
reliever here, he's 21 as a rookie, but that's
what I mean.
Done. Yeah,
he was born in November 5th, 1987. So during his freshman year in college, he was 20. I don't know. He just wasn't like Kobe coming out of high school at age 17. The Mark Jackson did this draft. At one point, he said he thought the Knicks should take the best available guy.
Not wrong.
The Clippers took Eric Gordon, and I wrote in the draft diary, here come the Clippers at number 7, ready to ruin yet another promising career. And the lucky loser is Eric Gordon. Logical pick. I can't say a bad thing about it. Right spot for him, right team. I look forward to watching the hope get sucked out of him over these next few years. It's exactly what happened. Super talented guy. Couldn't have been a worse team for him, and then gets thrown into the Chris Paul trade, and we'll talk about him later, but that was a bummer.
Yeah, but his third year, he put up pretty big numbers. And
yeah, he's... save it for the Eric Gordon part. Save it for Eric Gordon. Charlotte took DJ Augustine over Brooke Lopez. That was the thing that happened. And then Andy Katz said... The Kings took Jason Thompson at 12. Andy Katz said he was the best player they worked out. And I made the point, that's always smart. Ignore 4 years of his college games. Concentrate on the two workouts.
He had a little run,
teams
though.
Do this.
He did have a little moment there in the beginning. And then it was all of a sudden he didn't have a position. And it was like, no, it's over now, man. That was another weird one. God, there are a lot of weird stories in this draft.
He's one of those guys that would have been way better off if he came in the league in 1984. and he's just like battling Michael Cage and Buck Williams. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. All right, it's time. We're redrafting. You want the first pick or the second pick? Second pick's more interesting.
I think the thing is the third pick is the interesting thing. So you know what? You can have the first pick.
Well, if you think the third pick's interesting,
I want to see what you're going to do. No, I want to see what you're going to do.
All right, first pick, Russell Westbrook. We already talked about him. MVP, 2 first-team All-NBAs, 5 second teams, 2 third teams, averaging a 25-7-8 in the playoffs, 23-7-8 for his career. And we've talked about him way too much on this podcast. I don't have a lot more to say. I will be interested to know how much is left for him. He's already at 20,000 points. He's played 12 years, 874 games. The next 5 years of his career are going to be fun to see how they play out from athleticism, durability, all that stuff. You could tell me that it's going to be a quick downturn, or you could tell me he's just a freak and he's going to just be doing this until like he's 38. I don't know the answer.
I wouldn't want to bet against him finding a way to be productive just because of his intensity. Like, I just think that's the way this guy is wired, and that's the part of him I love the most. I do think our reaction to him would be very different if it wasn't, maybe not very different, because this is a bigger picture thing. But the way he turned it around this year, too, in Houston, after it being just abysmal the first few months, and then they get rid of the center, they open the whole thing up, and he's putting up these monster numbers again. But I just think wherever he is, I don't know that you're going to win any playoff games, but wherever he is, he's just going to care more than almost everybody else that's out there. And he's just going to find, like, he's going to get those in-between buckets. He's going to get buckets that other guys just don't have the effort level for. So I think he's always going to be kind of productive even later on as the athleticism slips.
You're up on the clock, number two.
By the way, Russ has 7,000 more points than anyone in this class, 3,000 more assists, 3,300 more assists, and he's third in rebounds this entire class. Okay, I don't really think there's much debate here. I think it's Kevin Love. Love, it's a weird story for him, though. I mean, monster numbers, like exactly what you would want. Stretch four, who is incredible from the three-point line. For his career, he's 37%. But 1 year with Minnesota, he's 42%. The next year, he's 26 points a game, 13 boards. He's got another 20 and 15 game in there or season in there. He had like a weird year where he couldn't hit any threes for some. Oh, he was hurt that year.
He hurt his hand or his wrist.
That's right. He played 18 games.
He made a second team All-NBA in 12 and 14, and then 13 he was hurt.
That's right. Okay, so then he comes back and plays basically a full season at 25 years old with Minnesota. His last year there, he's 26, 12 and a half, 38% from three and seven attempts. But it was this constant battle. Like, Rambis didn't want to play him. They gave him the shorter year on the contract. They're like, is this guy... You know, like some of these guys in this class, like, hey, what happened to OJ Mayo's numbers? Well, the weird thing is once he started shooting less, the team got a little bit better. There's a few guys in this, like when Beasley has those big numbers, okay, they didn't even win 20 games that year. So there's, you always got to look at some of these numbers and go, what do these numbers really mean when the teams are losing all the time? Then you can see the teams get a little bit better and then these guys take less shots. That's not necessarily the case for Love. He goes to Cleveland. We know there's not going to be as many shots for him. He loses like 6 shots per game from 14 to his first year in Cleveland, but he's still hitting threes. He's just missing time. He missed most in 18, 19. He's still only 31 years old. So I think he's oddly, like I said before, become a little underrated, but he's so lost in Cleveland and he signs the big contract. But he's a productive player who's put up maybe misleading, gaudy numbers, but still puts up really good numbers. But he was invisible in LeBron's shadow and now invisible on a bad team no one cares about.
I have 2 Kevin Love points. First one is, I really like the early version of Kevin Love before he actually was overqualified to be doing what he was doing, and it made more sense for him to be a 26 and 12 year guy at the end of games guy. His third season in the league, he averages 20 and 15, 4.5 offensive rebounds a game. 4.5.
Yeah, he led the league in rebounding.
And when you went to see him, it was so much fun watching him on the offensive boards because he really like was religious about, you know, a little like Rodman style. It was one of the best rebounders I've ever seen. And I think it's a shame that as his career went along, he drifted further and further away from the basket. You take this guy when he's around the rim, one of the best offensive rebounders, I think, of the last 20 years. And then as a defensive rebounder, one of the best outlet passers. And yeah. I just love that version of him. I really wish he didn't go to Cleveland, which is my second point. And I know it worked out. They won the title, the whole thing. But I think for the most part, it's been a waste of his talents. Because I think LeBron, in a lot of ways, was a power forward anyway. If you just look at his playoff stats, right? He's only in the playoffs 4 years. His playoff stats, he's 15-10, 40% field goal, 40% three-point, 85% free throw, only 2.3 offensive rebounds a game. And here's the killer, 3.7 free throws a game. He's basically being used as Ryan Anderson, and I just think it's a complete waste of what that guy's good at. I want that guy around the rim. He's got unbelievable hands, quick feet, some of the best instincts we've seen of anyone in the last 25 years, and you have him in the fucking corner. I know they had to do it that way, but I just think it's a shame. I wish we could do his career over again.
That 25-year-old season, 13-14 again, 77 games, 26, 12.5, 8 free throw attempts per game, and he makes his free throws. He's 83% from the floor.
He was unstoppable in the paint. Like, if there was a rebound, he was usually getting it. He was great at up fake stuff. Like, he was a very old school kind of the player that you and I grew up with, like navigating modern world, but he could shoot. Like, I just think it's a bummer he went to Cleveland. I really do. And that's not a knock on LeBron. I think he was overqualified to do what he did for Cleveland.
JD Drew rule here in effect, because if they don't come back from 3-1, do we look at his career differently?
I'm looking at his career as a guy who in the playoffs is 15-10, which is just not that special. And I got to be honest.
By the way, those numbers feel high because of how many times in the playoffs you were like, what's going on with him right now?
Right. They're a little inflated by some of the easy series. I got to be honest. I had him third. I had Derrick Rose second. So here's the case.
You think it's not even debatable, huh?
No, I think it's very debatable. Okay. I had Rose second on my list because he's an MVP. I think that matters. I think the injury was a fluke. Maybe it would have happened anyway because the way he played. I certainly was afraid watching him that he was going to get hurt. And I always have felt that way about Westbrook too. Certain guys where you're John Morant's like that. I'm constantly worried he's going to get hurt by the way he plays. So maybe it would have happened anyway. I don't know. But, you know, you think like year three, wins the MVP. He's the best guy in a 60-win team. 25-7-4, 45%, 33-86. For the percentages, and he's like 22. And the question I keep asking with some of this stuff is, if you play his career 20 times, is this one of the best versions, one of the mediocre versions, or one of the worst versions? I think it's probably one of the worst versions. I think there's a world where Westbrook and Rose, if Westbrook hurts his knee, maybe, as you pointed out before, Westbrook's so tough mentally, he was going to fight through it. Rose, he has a lot of issues, obviously. Maybe he's not as strong fighting through an injury and recovering, things like that. But I just think it was bad luck. And I think the upside of him was just higher than Kevin Love. I think he's a better basketball player. Kevin Love, to me, if he's putting up huge stats, I don't know if you're winning. And it's weird because it's almost like the most overqualified ever version of David Lee. Where it's like, if David Lee is this involved in your team, what's ultimately happening? Because he can't guard anybody on the other end. Now we know with the league where it's like, you don't really need a power forward who's 6'9", who's constantly in a mismatch, getting in pick and rolls, but he can't play center. So that would be I know what Derrick Rose is. I know I can contend for a title if he's one of my best three players, he's healthy.
I guess I just push back on the idea that because the ACL thing happened, that's fluky, and then none of the other stuff is fluky, because it was a real problem for him in Chicago when he came back and how long it took him to come back and what was happening. And, you know, this was some of the early signs of the pro player coverage in that it's like, well, you know, it's his body. And if he's worried, it's like, yeah, okay. But, you know, eventually when you're cleared and people want you back and think you're coming back and have a uniform ready for you to go in a playoff game, and then you're not, like, that's screwing up everybody else on the team. And remember the Knicks moment where he just disappeared? And
well, I think,
you go, what's right. going on? And it was actually, like, the fact that he is who he is the last 2 years, Bill, is incredible. And it's, you know, like, I'm so happy for him, because I hate, like you, that we missed out on this awesome version. But if we're doing this redraft and, like, what you have to your team, there was some real weird moments there for Rose where I guess I can't really blame him, a young kid whose career is completely derailed based on, like, being a Hall of Famer, maybe contending for titles. But there was some stuff that was really hard to explain with him for a bunch of seasons. And he basically missed like 5 or 6 years, not total, but seasons where he doesn't even come close to playing a half a year.
He reminds me of a lot of guys that we grew up watching that I loved who got derailed for dumb reasons. You know, whether it was Michael Ray Richardson or Walter Davis, guys like that, because of cocaine, or guys who just had a knee injury at the wrong time, or both. But you look back at their career, what it should have been versus what it actually was. And I always look at that and I'm like, well, why did it turn out that way? With him, I think the knee injury was bad luck. I don't think he had the kind of infrastructure around him to kind of cope with the bad luck. Whereas I think if Westbrook had torn his ACL, he would have been back in 11 months. He would have been like, I'm not letting this beat me. For whatever reason, Rose let it beat him. And I think he had a really hard life and he had a lot of issues on and off the court. And, you know, it's just a bummer. I remember in my basketball book, I had a Hall of Fame. I wanted to have these different wings. And one of the wings was like the Comets, like these guys that, they weren't Hall of Famers, but they had like this 2-year window where you're like, man, I'll never forget watching that guy. I feel like he's like that for me. He's one of those comic guys for me. I thought he was unbelievable in person those couple years.
Yeah, it's tough for me to win the argument with Love over Rose, though, when you talk about winning games, because Rose was winning games. I mean, they won 58 games that year as MVP. They were the one seed in the East. Or excuse me, they won 62 games. Miami, as I said before, won 58. And Love was almost like power forward Trae Young in a way.
He was. And he was so, you know, the Sharif Abdur-Rahim All-Stars, I used to call him. You want him on the fantasy team, but not in real life as much. But, yeah. You know, I got to say, he came through huge in the in 2016. Like that he stopped Curry on the biggest defensive stop of that entire season and made a couple big plays, and that counts for something.
I did have a few Warriors people reach out on the Love Curry thing, and they were quick to point out that Curry admits he just was going for the kill shot there, because I still think he could have gotten around Kevin Love.
Well, that's another what if with him, right? Because it was Klay Thompson, David Lee for Love was the trade that was on the table, and the Warriors were split on it, and ended up not doing it, and probably a good idea because, you know, how it played out. All right, you're on the clock at number 4.
I'm going to go with somebody who statistically is, well, he's actually a little higher up in the mix, but I'm going Brook Lopez.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
This is a fun draft.
Yeah. Now,
I had Lopez, him sixth.
Lopez went from 20 a game, not great Nets teams, didn't rebound enough, set up so far away from the hoop, and you're like, what the hell is this? Like, why are you posting up on a entry pass? Like, why am I, you're catching a ball 18 feet away from the hoop and you're just going to take a turnaround? But he got enough shots, and he also got to the free throw line, and he was pretty good from his free throw line. But you went from like, oh man, he just doesn't, because he rebounded all right his first couple of years. It just got worse and worse. You're like, why, this guy just doesn't rebound. And then he completely reinvents himself, signs for just above the minimum, essentially. And somebody that didn't take any threes the first 7-8 years of his career, 5 a game, 4 a game, 6 a game, 5 a game. He wasn't shooting it as well this year with Milwaukee, but he was great the previous 3 years from three, and he's reinvented himself. And I think as a mobile defensive big who can cover a lot of ground, I actually still think he's going to be productive for a while. So I like him better than some of the other people that statistically are looked on more favorably from this class.
Averaged 20 plus four times. Had some bad luck with how it worked out for him, right? They put together that Nets super team and Darren Williams just ends up flaking. He's there through the whole fall of Prokhorov era. Ends up on the 2018 Lakers for some reason. And it's just, I'm with you. I always liked him. I always thought he was kind of semi-unstoppable when he posted up. And there was one of the years the Celtics had both of the years, they had the Nets pick. And my dad and I would just be rooting against the Nets. And Lopez would just like win the Nets these games. And it was so fucking frustrating. And be like, you know, they're down one with 11 seconds left coming out of a timeout. Like, just double team Lopez. Can he not have the ball? And then he'd end up, you know, and one Brooke Lopez. And I just thought he was really good. So I'm glad it worked out for him. But he's another guy like same way I feel about Kevin Love. I hate that all these guys are so far from the basket. I think he's like unstoppable within 6 feet if he's got the right guy in his hip, you know, and now he's just like a 3-point shooter.
Yeah, but now he's not even that guy. And I think that's why I actually like him more, because before it was just weird with him. He would set up so much further away than normally a guy on a post catch. Now nobody runs post offense anyway, so it doesn't even matter. Done. But I mean, the other crazy thing about him, the last couple of years, he's basically a career high blocks per game, which doesn't happen. Usually you don't play 10 years and then start blocking more shots. But a lot of that is how smart he is, and he's also high on the teammate grade thing too. So
totally, and the defensive metrics back it up. The eye test says he's kind of better defensively than I realized he was, and then all the metrics are backing up. My fifth pick is going to be Serge Ibaka. I just love guys like this. I know I can just play him in a playoff series, and he's probably going to be playing crunch time for me unless I have an awesome center. The some of his numbers, like in 2012, he averaged 3.7 blocks a game. I don't remember that. That's a lot of blocks. He averaged 3 blocks a game in 13.
Then he just stopped.
Yeah, but became, for the most part, a pretty good open 3-point shooter eventually. Unfortunately, he didn't really learn that skill until after OKC, their window closed for the title. But in the playoffs, he did pretty well too. Is somebody that he played 133 games in the playoffs so far and averaged 29 minutes a game. So he was always valuable at every point in his career. In Toronto, 20.8 minutes a game for them in the 19 run. And he came up huge for them a couple of times during that run. I just always liked him. And I think in 2014, when he gets hurt in that San Antonio series, and then he ends up coming back and whatever the fuck happened. I do think they could have beaten San Antonio that year. And I think his injury changed that. So
I had him fifth. I had him fifth as well. You know, I had Westbrook, Love, Rose thing. You kind of get me to second guess the Bros thing a little bit there, but.
No, I think it's a good argument.
Yeah. And then I had Lopez fourth, but I had Serge fifth. Serge is such an interesting player because he basically was a power forward forever, and then he turned into like a two guard on offense, and he went from not taking any threes to taking three a game, and he hit him. But I felt like his blocks overrated him a little defensively, where I thought that Miami series he made some huge mistakes, just kind of not understanding the coverage on some things.
Are you talking 2012?
Like, yeah, when they lost in the finals to Miami.
Yeah, he was pretty raw. I felt like it took him a couple years to really be trustworthy in games like that.
Yeah, I mean, his third year in. He wasn't even a scorer at that point. But the blocks, those next couple years, like that's 3.7. So that's a third year in. So that's when they were in the finals. Blocks can get really, I mean, that's a huge number. So you start to go, look at this defensive stopper. And it's like, okay, blocking shots, though. Like, look at Whiteside. Like, Whiteside blocks shots. And I think he's one of the worst defensive players in the league. And so...
Isn't it weird though when you look back and you think they just could have played him at center and Durant at power forward and had two guys who were 7 feet and have length, and then just like, why play Perkins 1 minute?
Because who else are you going to run that first post play for every single game to start the game? You can't do that to Big Perk. Ibaka, you know, the redemption for me, because then I kind of felt like he was this lost guy, because I go, he's so far away from the hoop all the time, like he's in love with his shot, and he made it. But you kind of hope, like, where you have this great defensive presence who can also be a big who can shoot threes, and you're like, actually, you have just a big who shoots a lot of threes. But he was so good in big spots against Golden State when they won the title for Toronto. Like, he had some moments where he's the only other guy doing anything.
Remember the Philly
going off? Yeah.
Game 7 Philly, too. That was the other one. He was big.
That was the other
one.
So he jumped up in my book as it kind of just being like, about him for a long time. I'm not saying he sucked or anything like that. I'm not being ridiculous. But for him to show up that way like he did for Toronto during that championship run really showed me something with him. So,
and I think if you have him for 12 years, you're going to be just happy in general with the 12 years. I forgot, Zach Cram sent us a couple stats. 7 different guys from this draft made an all-star team, which is the most in any draft since 2003. The average player from the draft has collected 24.9 win shares, most since 2003. And the total win shares for non-lottery players in 2008, which includes Ibaka, ranks 3rd in the whole lottery era. So there you go. All right, you're in the clock at number 6. I think I know who you're taking.
DeAndre Jordan?
Are you being ironic?
No, I'm taking him.
Wow, I never thought you were a fan.
Well, at this point, I wouldn't say that. Like, I think he's a classic Chris Paul study, where it's like, oh, see what happens when you don't have Chris Paul passing you the basketball every single time. Like, it's a little harder to get this stuff going. But the rebounding numbers are nuts. He's got like 2,500 more rebounds than anybody else in this class. He led the league 13.5, 15. He's basically been double figures for a really long time. Yes, there are some Dallas moments there where it's like, I don't think this guy's real locked in right now. And that part I never quite got. But he's the whole reason why Durant's in Brooklyn. Oh, no, wait, that's Kyrie. I think DeAndre, when he's right, when he's invested, it's tough because, you know, you want everybody to be able to score. So in today's game, you know, he might not be somebody you have to do, but you still have to kind of pay attention to him. And I was kind of at this point, like, there's one other name that I would go with, but I could understand. I probably had more arguments for the guy that I was going to pick after DeAndre here than I had anti DeAndre arguments. So I'm taking him 6th.
You left out the dunking with him, which was really fun. Especially earlier in his career with the alley-oop. with the alley-oops. It was just, he had a fun early part of his career when he wasn't like a distinct potential all-star yet, but was just a fun guy to have on your team. And also great teammate. Everybody likes him. I did not have him in that spot though.
Okay. Who would you take?
I, with my 7th pick, I'm taking Eric Gordon, who I think is a really good basketball player, who is a classic. If you played this career 20 times, was this the worst scenario of it? I'm just looking at this draft. The actual draft, Chicago Rose, Miami Beasley, Minnesota Mayo trade, Seattle Westbrook, Memphis Love, Knicks 6, they take Gallinari, Clippers 7, Eric Gordon, 8, Milwaukee, Joe Alexander. Even if he goes to the Bucks at 8 and he's playing with like Andrew Bogut and whoever else on that Fear the Deer team, I think he would have had such an easier time. Instead, he's on the fucked up Clippers. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, when things finally start turning, gets traded to New Orleans. Now it's another rebuild. Then they get Drew Holiday within a year. Then a couple years go by. He gets hurt a few times. They have, by all accounts, one of the worst medical staffs in the last 20 years of the NBA. Then eventually ends up in Houston, and we kind of saw what would become with him. But he's just worst case scenario on whatever team, 17 a game, and he's going to make almost 40% of his threes, knows where to go, knows what to do. You can run plays for him at the end of games. His 3rd year with the Clippers, he was 22.3 a game, 45% field goal. And I got to say, that was a really fun Clippers team, because that was Blake. That was, there was Baron Davis for at least a little while, and then they ended up trading Baron Davis to get rid of his contract for Mo Williams. But I really like going to those games. I like Baron Davis with Eric Gordon and DeAndre starting to come on and Blake starting to emerge. And I enjoyed that team. Like, it's a team that if they hadn't made the Chris Paul trade, still would have been really fun to watch.
Yeah, he was really coming on, and there were some other numbers too. Like, I think he might have been the number one like shoot off a pick and roll guard in the league that year, where you go, okay, this guy has like a real weapon and something to bring. And it was always a little scary because when you watched him, for those that saw him in high school and then the year at Indiana, it was really impressive. But you were kind of like, what kind of athlete is he going to be? Is he going to be one of those guys that's like done athletically too soon? And that's kind of the case, but it hasn't really, like, yes, it's changed who he is as a player, but he's still incredibly productive. I know he wasn't shooting it that well this year, but this is somebody who just lights it up from outside, taking over 8 threes a game now. I mean, he scored 18 a game over basically a full season just a couple years ago. And he's, yes, the system, it's the Houston system, and it's all these things, but you'd still want an Eric Gordon on your team. And I think because he always looks a little slower. He looks like he's never quite the athlete maybe you thought you were going to be when you watched him when he was a little bit younger. But I think the part that's misleading is because he doesn't look like he's this quick twitch guy or a guy who's breaking everybody down. It takes away from the fact that he actually is good at getting to the hoop. Like, he is good at initiating contact. And because he's thick, it works to his advantage. Like, these guys are, all of those Rockets players are big in not height, but like just how strong they all are. And he fits in perfectly with all these different things because he can still handle. And even though he looks like this guy who's just going to take a million threes every game, he's somebody that can still handle and get to the hoop and then make the right read on stuff. So I've been really impressed with the second part of his career after worrying like who he was going to be after some of the injuries and then the weird stuff with his contract and like he wanted out and then they weren't going to let him out when he wanted to go to Phoenix. I mean, he had some weird bumpy stuff there where you started worrying like what's this going to look like in year 10 if he's even still around. And now I think he's just going to make threes for another 5 years.
At least. There's this one really fun game from 2011. It was right before they traded Baron. They beat the Lakers. It was a home Clippers game. Gordon had 30 against Kobe. And for whatever reason, every time they played the Lakers, one of the things I liked about him as a young player was he kind of felt like, oh, it's me and Kobe. It's the two of us. Like, he's one of those irrational guys.
Yeah.
But but it was like, oh, it's time for me and Kobe to have a duel. But so he has 30. Griffin has 18 and 15. DeAndre has 15 rebounds. Baron has 14 and 8. And they beat the Lakers. And I don't know. I felt like they were kind of building something there, and that obviously you have to trade for Chris Paul. That was a no-brainer. But I think him and Blake Griffin would have been a good combo the next couple of years.
Yeah, but you're right.
You're up at number 8.
Danilo.
I that was my toughest call, was who to put at number 8.
I think you can make an argument he should have gone ahead of Gordon. I don't know if you wanted me to keep updating these, though, just all the stuff that we have on the nicknames off of Basketball Reference, because Eric Gordon's got a bunch, a.k.a. The Hobbit, a.k.a. E-Money, a.k.a. E.G., a.k.a. E.J., a.k.a. Splash Gordon, a.k.a. 3G, a.k.a. Air Gordon.
I think they make almost all of those names up, the Basketball Reference ones. Half of those too. I've never heard in my life. So Gallinari is 16-5, 38% from three for his career.
And he's getting better, by the way. Do you realize like what he's done the last couple of years on two different stops?
I enjoyed him. I liked him on the Clippers. And he's had three different runs on teams that weren't supposed to be as good as they were where he was involved, right? That 2013 Nuggets team, the heyday of Ty Lawson. I think they won like 57 games. That Clippers team last year, when all of a sudden they were like, what, 49-33 or whatever. They win a game off the Warriors. And then this OKC team this year, he was a big part of that. Him and Chris Paul and Shai Gilgeous and Steven Adams, that was basically it. But he is somebody that we have seen over and over again does stuff that helps the team. And if he's one of your 6 guys, you're not going to regret it. Celtics have liked him for 10 years.
He's had a weird career because he had bad first impression, 28 games, rookie year. And I think he'd be like one of your friends that has a good run and then he does something really stupid like once every year. And then you're like, ah, this guy.
Yeah.
That's what Danilo's career is like. Because just when it seems like it's getting steady, then he misses time. He gets traded.
Dumb injury.
He missed the entire 13-14. And then with Denver, he started to put up some pretty big numbers. Again, shorter seasons. But he's played, I don't know. I mean, geez, he hasn't played over 70 games since 12-13. That's really his problem. The perception of him isn't inaccurate, that he isn't around a lot. But he is a more productive player than you realize. He's 43% and 41% from three the last couple of years. He's scoring 20 and 19. Clippers last year in 68 games, 55 games with Oklahoma City this year. He's still a decent enough rebounder. He can make a pass, makes his free throws, and he's still only 31 years old. But
when, and he's got a little of that Italian in him too.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm half Italian. I'm qualified to talk about this. He thinks he's a little better than he is. He carries himself with, "Hey, fuck you." And
have you ever heard him say that?
No. In crunch time, not going to be scared.
Yes.
He's going to be like, "Hey, what are you looking at?" And I don't know. I always, as a fellow Italian, I always appreciated the way he carried himself.
I think you just want to say he smokes cigarettes and drives a Vespa. I think that's what you're trying to say.
Not somebody who would be like, "Where is this guy going in crunch time?" Like, I actually think the opposite. So, all right. So I had him ranked 9th, and I'm going to take with the 9th pick the guy I had 8th. I just like him. Goran Dragic. Third team All-NBA in 2014. One of the weirdest careers, one of the weirdest basketball reference pages you'll look at, because he's basically a bench guy for the first 5 years of his career. And then within a year, he's third team All-NBA. And he's a guy that if I was a GM, I would have traded for at least once. I've always liked his game. I'll never understand why Phoenix tried to put him and Isaiah Thomas together. That was fucking weird. Was valued enough that Miami gave up 2 unprotected first round picks for him. Like, that's how much talent he had. I don't think Gallinari, Eric Gordon, maybe Ibaka would have gone for 2 unprotecteds at some point. I don't know. But when he's good, he is a 20-6, and he's going to make 4 out of every 10 threes. And you can run pick and rolls with him at the end of the game. And is a good playoff guy and single-handedly knocked the 2010 Spurs out of the playoffs, which was unbelievable as it was happening. I'm a fan.
Yeah, 2 years ago in a full season, he was 17-5-4, and he shot, what was he at? I mean, he's had some big three-point shooting seasons. Yeah, he's 41% from three. I think he's healthier than people realize. Like, last year he missed a ton of time. He's coming off the bench this year, but he's still scoring 16 a game for a good Miami team that, if it weren't for their road record, maybe I think could make a little noise in the playoffs. Maybe they still can. But he, you know, before that, 2 years ago, you go back 75 games, 73 games, 78 games, 76 games, 77 games. So other than the never starting any of the games and coming off the bench and playing under like 20 minutes a game for 4 seasons in, or actually, excuse me.
Yeah, but, we got to say why, though. Because he's Nash's backup. And I think there came a point where he was really overqualified to be a backup point guard in the league. I think he was better than probably 10 guys who was actually starting. Like, guys like DJ Augustine were starting games when he was backing up Nash. So, you know, a little bit bad luck there. On the other hand, you could argue playing with Nash, he might have learned some stuff that became valuable going forward. But I was just really appreciating him. He's one of my favorites.
At this point, I think we've had close to the same order. It just seems to be we're one off every time where I have a guy that you take, you know, the slot behind.
We can start moving faster now, by the way.
Probably. George Hill. I'll take him 10.
Good pick. I agree. 26th pick in the actual draft. Good enough to get traded for Kawhi Leonard. I think he's had a really nice resurgence on this Bucks team.
He's leading the league in threes at 48% this year.
Yeah.
There's really not much else to add. You know who he is. You know what you're going to get.
I think if he's your third guard, you're feeling great.
Yeah.
If you're an 8-man rotation and he's playing 24 minutes a game, you did awesome.
He's actually 5th in win shares for this class, too.
Interesting. I remember when Zach wrote the piece about the Hill-Leonard trade for us for Grant.
Zach Randolph?
Zach Lowe.
Oh.
And Zach Randolph never wrote for Grantland. Pop was like devastated when he had to trade George Hill. He loved George Hill. it was just the right move because he had Parker, and Parker was still one of the best 15 or 16 guys in the league. And at some point, they needed a wing guy, and they knew it, and they love Kawhi, and they made the deal.
But just think, if they had traded Parker for Valanciunas, then Kawhi's never on the Spurs, and maybe they still have George Hill.
And the Celtics could add Robert Swift. Number 11. I'm taking a guy who has made $118 million in counting in his NBA career.
No, you're not. I don't even have him in my lottery.
Yeah, I'm going 3 and D. I'm taking Nick Batum. I'm doing it.
It's tough to be 3 and D when you play 0 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I liked him for a while, and, you know, unfortunately, he got a giant contract, and it fucked him up. And so I am using that giant contract as kind of the torn ACL of Nick Batum's career. But, you know, you're looking at from 2010 all the way through 2018, he is 13-6-5, 35% from three. Like, he's basically Wes Matthews or whatever, and he could switch on D with him, all that stuff. I would rather have that than anyone who's left. So you're up 12.
I'm just going to add a couple of Batum nuggets.
Yeah.
The advanced metrics haven't liked him in 8 years. That Charlotte team isn't loaded. They don't even play him, and he's healthy. I think his playoff numbers are pretty bad as well. Not that there's a ton there, but they get even worse. He was a guy that had this all-around game, and he put it together for Portland there a little bit, and they had no problem not Matt, like, going, go ahead, $120 million. He still is a $27 million player option next year. Probably going to pick that one up. I just, there's more anti-Batum stuff for me, but it does get a little scarce here, so I'm not crushing the pick yet.
Hold on. It doesn't just get a little scarce here. Who's left, just for the people listening. I'm not happy I took Nick Batum, but here's who's left. JaVale McGee, Roy Hibbert, Nikola Pekovic, Ryan Anderson, Omer Asik, Robin Lopez, Michael Beasley, OJ Mayo, Mo Spates, Courtney Lee. Chalmers, Mozgov. Like, it's not like
Embrace debate.
It's not like my grocery cart was full.
What about Anthony Randolph? Different life, maybe.
By the way, still haven't given up on him. You always ask me, who have I not given up on from this draft? Anthony Randolph. Still waiting for him to become a heat check guy off the bench.
Kyle Weaver, a lot of length there.
Who you taking at 12?
Just think I have to go production, long career. Give me DJ Augustine.
Wow. I did not have him on my list. Unbelievable. Hold on. I have to do some copy pasting. DJ Augustine. Even he's bummed out that you took him.
All right. I can't wait because I was saving my 14th pick for somebody you weren't going to take. So now I may have jammed myself up unless, I don't know, because I didn't think there's any way the guy I took last is who you were going to take in your top 14. So I may have just screwed myself. What's wrong with August? You see when they beat the Raptors in game one of the playoffs? And he was like, don't you sleep on the Magic?
Look, anytime you can get a point guard with a career 10-4, got to lock that down. There's no way to find that.
He's going
to
be on a roster. He's on a roster really long. It gets really slim here, folks.
I can't believe he's played 20,000 minutes.
Yeah. Maybe Jesus. you need to brush up on your DJ Augustine before you start killing him.
No, that
I know who you're going to take. I know who you're going to take.
Yeah, I'm going to take JaVale.
Oh my God, you're making fun of me?
Yeah. I'm taking JaVale. Watched him play on a team that might have been the best team ever. And he played 9.6 minutes a game. And then in the playoffs, I think he played more than that. For the 2017 Warriors, he played 9.3 minutes a game.
Wow.
He's been in the league.
Oh, I know. Since 2008?
He's been in the league for 12 years, but is still like... pretty relatively relevant. He's playing 17 minutes a game right now for the best team in the league other than Milwaukee. And I don't feel like he's on his way out of the league.
He can thank LeBron for that offensive production right now, because everybody leaves him. Same for Dwight, right?
Well,
now.
Let me ask you, is it harder to find JaVale McGee or DJ Augustine just in the league?
I don't know. What guy is
harder to find? That was my mindset completely. Could he play 15 minutes a game for me off the bench as a pick and roll rim protector guy? Yes.
I take
JaVale McGee.
Do you know that DJ Augustine has a PER for his career of 14.2?
Is that good?
Do you want to take any of it back?
14.2? That seems high. Well, I'm taking JaVale. I liked his mom. I had a good time with his mom at the USC when we did the doc at the party after. She was a delight.
Augustine, 38% from three in the playoffs for his career. 33 games. Not a small sample.
That's pretty good.
I'm just screwing with everybody right
Maybe,
now.
Maybe. No, we should do a book. I'll do on the Book of Basketball Twitter feed. Who would you take in a redraft, JaVale or DJ Augustine?
I'm going to lose because everybody likes JaVale, and now he's on the Lakers, and all the Lakers fans are going to like go crazy.
Oh, yeah, you're right. They ruin everything. Laker fans just ruin all good things. All right, last pick.
I'm not going to take him, but he probably should have gone 12 or 13, and that's Ryan Anderson. Ryan Anderson filled it up. Now, Ryan Anderson has a little bit of some of the other stuff that we've seen with this class. It's the less he started shooting, the team started winning a little bit more, because it's like, well, can we give Ryan Anderson all of our shots? Like, how many games do we expect to win? But he lit it up there for a while. Also, you want to take a guess over-under? Well, I'm not going to give you over-under. I'll just give you the guess. You want to guess his career earnings?
Oh, it's like $130 million, right?
Something 100. Crazy. Yeah, he's over 100. 100 mil for Ryan Anderson.
Yeah, he was the other guy I was looking at with that last pick.
All right, my last pick, though, I'm just going to take him. I'm taking Robin Lopez.
If you ask teams, and this was one of those things where it was like a trade deadline making the calls, and it was like, watch how hard. It's like that Varejao thing where Varejao may not get the rebound, but it's going to be annoying all night long trying to battle this guy for rebounds, and he's locked in, he's competitive, and all that kind of stuff. And I think for the 14th pick here, none of the traditional stats are going to get you all that excited about Robin Lopez, but I just think he makes things difficult on the opponent. And I like guys like that, especially if they're coming off the bench and they're the last pick in the lottery.
You know what? That's a better pick than JaVale. I regret my JaVale pick now. I'm with you. I've always liked Robin Lopez. For some reason, he bounces around. He's been on six teams. Nobody ever seems totally happy with him, but I've always enjoyed him. That's a good pick. That's a good ender. Tough podcast for Roy Hibbert.
Or Omar Asik.
Roy Hibbert was, you know, we were writing like giant Greatland features about Roy Hibbert. And then he was out of the league 2 years later. And there's really never been an explanation.
He you know what? That, 9 years. That's a great way. Like, because we've already gone over it here. And everybody knows the Roy Hibbert story. But it ended so quickly. And he was so irrelevant so fast. I think that's almost canceling out like how good he was there. Like, should he have been the 13th or 14th pick in this?
He was in the mix. But this, by the way, this was a really good draft. But you look at 2012 and 13 playoffs, 30 playoff games. He averages 15 and 10, 2.4 blocks. Prompts the Kurt Goldsberry verticality feature. And was really ahead of his time. And then the league changed and he got fucked. And it happened with Pera Antic, that Atlanta series when he just stood 25 feet from the basket and it completely fucked the Pacers up. And that was it. And then basketball changed.
Can you imagine though? That's like, it's one thing when you're a guy who gets cut and you're at the end of your career and you go, okay, look, in 5 years, I'll admit I'm just not good enough, but right now I can't do it. But to be Hibbert and go, so basically because the other guys stand so far away, I suck now? Like, that's it.
Yeah. Well, that was fun. 2008 in the books. You're doing at least two podcasts this week, right?
Yeah, we got a bunch of cool stuff. We just finished up with Van Pelt, and also check out the because I want to have this conversation. We'll have it, you know, I'll just regurgitate the same stuff, you know, because at that point it'll be 6 weeks later. Nobody will remember. But just the obsession with trying to figure out, like, why teams that were four or five seeds are going to somehow be better now than the teams that were really good. Like, so why are the best teams now at a disadvantage? And it can't just be as simple as home court. But I feel like a lot of people are trying to get more creative with who they're picking. Van Pelt was on with us, but we have a famous movie producer on this week. So we're going to, he's going to tell me stories. I've already been prepped up on it. He's going to tell me awesome stories about producing some of the biggest movies you've ever watched. So there you go.
Awesome. Well, we will definitely be around when the basketball playoffs hopefully come back. We might be a little spotty the next couple of weeks, just if there's nothing to talk about, but we'll figure out something. Ryan Russillo, pleasure as always.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks for listening to the Book of Basketball podcast. If you want to hear the other redraftables we did, check them out. They are all on the Book of Basketball 2.0 feed. See you next time.